This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, should say host, but also realtors with Oakwind Realty in downtown Vancouver. So excited for today. We've got Brendan Augmanson back by popular demand. Of course, he is BCREA's chief economist.
That's right. It's chief economist. He's only been on the show 10 times. Chief economist. That's right.
Yeah. And fan favorite for sure. We brought Brendan back on because we're at the halfway mark for 2026. How has the market been? And where are we headed? That's the big out.
We also talk BC condo bailout, good policy from what we know so far, but also what does that do for the market? Any lasting impacts? How does it impact real estate, the resale market, the real estate resale market? It's a fantastic conversation and yeah, always great to have Brendan on the show.
But before we get to that, Matt, of course, we have the headlines from the week, the realist headlines, which are real estate headlines in Greater Vancouver, brought to you, of course, by Howard Chai, The Realist, a Substack publication that Howard Chai founded. If you want to learn more, of course, you can head over to howardchai.substack.com. This week's headlines, and some actually from last week, Matt, because we were off last week with the end of school. But so, of course, the federal-provincial condo conversion partnership continued to dominate the news last week and the week before. But this week, we found out that Prime Minister Mark Carney has confirmed that there will be a rent-to-own component. Still waiting on a lot of details here on this, but we'll be talking about them in the weeks to come for sure.
Yeah, this is interesting. I don't remember a time where it was so often the case where government shot first and asked questions later, or in this case, shoots and then decides what the policy is going to be and offers little tidbits over the coming weeks. It seems like such a strange approach. But anyway, I'm going to comment on all these, Adam.
I feel like I've been there before with the provincial government, where a big announcement comes out and then slow details start to emerge. And
it's like, oh my God, we got to figure out what this means.
Yeah, exactly. The second headline is that Vancouver has adopted a new building seismic risk reduction action plan. This is what's involved here is they're establishing a working group, creating inventory of at-risk buildings and creating an incentivized retrofit program. So, overall, it sounds good. I think obviously there's a lot of buildings, particularly schools that I'm aware of that could use some seismic upgrading.
Yeah. So especially in the face of that Venezuela earthquake.
Where, no kidding.
Timely
for sure. And a couple just in the development world, Vancouver-based real estate developer Landmark Premier Properties. It continues to be in the news due to owner Helen Chan's son being jailed and declared bankrupt, is now facing a new insolvency proceeding for a project on Marine Drive. And also phase two of Nova by Mortise Group in Surrey has been placed under creditor protection by National Bank. Of course, the project's been under construction and National Bank is hoping to get it completed. But Mortise also previously faced a receivership on a commercial property in Surrey, which was sold earlier this year. So that's it for the week. It's kind of, with the exception of the condo bailout, the news cycle has been pretty slow for real estate.
That's right. It has been maybe a welcome relief to some of the news that we've heard. We do have that quiz segment, Adam, that we should move on to. It's not called the quiz segment, of course. It's called that segment that remains nameless. I'm going to change it up a little bit this week. I'm going to focus on the BC bailout. I want you to name the quote, okay? So I'm going to read you a quote. I'm going to give you four people, and I'm going to ask you to name who said this. So this is in response to the BC bailout. If you really think about it, it was a provincial government that instituted all these changes to help basically kill the condo market. Why don't you guys just reverse all of the measures that you put in originally to chase investors away? Wouldn't that be a better use of our public policy instead of using taxpayers' money, why don't we just stop doing stupid things?
Oh,
okay.
Words taken right out of my mouth.
Okay, so name that quote. I'm going to give you four people. Neil Crystal from Polygon Homes, past guest fan favorite. Rick Illich from Townline Homes, past guest fan favorite. Bo Jarvis from West Group Properties, past group fan favorite. Or Rick Joel, Zentera Developments, and friend of the program, because Zentera Developments advertises on the show. But before we get to that, Adam, I just wanted to highlight one of our new listings. We're moving into summer with a splash. 302-3737 Bartlett Court over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. This listing is exactly what this market needs and wants. Wrap around the balcony, over 700 square foot, one bed, fully renovated. You know, the market doesn't want projects. This is the definition of turnkey. This is over at the Maple, Adam, a solid concrete building in Sullivan Heights, right by Lougheed Town Center. The city of Lougheed actually is what it's called now. And Highway 1, SFU, what's not to love? This is over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. Once again, offered for $388,000, if you can believe it. $388,000. Fully renovated.
Sounds affordable. Yeah, find out more at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. This is a very tricky question. I didn't see the quote article. I didn't see the quote. It doesn't sound to me like Neil Crystal said that. I feel like I'm going to go Rick Joel.
You are correct, sir. I was thinking you potentially, I feel like Rick Illich is definitely speaking his mind these days. Bo Jarvis always does, but it was Rick Joel who said the quote. When I read it, I felt exactly the same as you. Man, I would have, this is exactly what I thought when this was announced. But yeah, we talk about that today on the show with Brendan Augmentson. So Adam, maybe we should just cut to our talk with BCREA chief economist, Brendan Augmentson.
Yeah. And if Eric Carlson was on that list, I think I would have guessed Eric Carlson. But anyways, yeah, we'll see on the other side. Zentera has done it again. Recently named Multifamily Home Builder of the Year by the Home Builders Association of Vancouver and the Canadian Home Builders Association of BC. Zentera continues to move forward on new projects. And their latest, Butte, a new condo community in West Clayton, is now selling. With construction already underway, buyers can purchase with confidence, knowing that the project is moving forward.
Butte offers 1, 2, and 3-bedroom condos located just 3 blocks to the future SkyTrain, Adam. These condos come with tons of inclusions like gas ranges, air conditioning, and designer-selected finishes. Residents will have access to the rooftop patio, fitness center, on-site daycare, co-working space, games room, and tons of outdoor space with 3 playgrounds. Estimated completion is summer 2028.
The best deals are happening now. Visit Zentera's home store in South Surrey to get all the details or check out the floor plans at buttecondos.ca. That's B-U-T-E condos.ca.
Hi, I'm Michael Yu.
And I'm Morgan Brown. And we're the founders of Oakland Realty. We have 9 offices across British Columbia.
Serving all major markets of BC. If you're an agent out there, just like Adam and Matt, who happen to be licensed at Oakwin, please reach out to us at oakwin.com/join and type into that message box, the rep, and you'll receive a free gift and a promotion when you meet one of our leaders.
Thanks so much, and we're looking forward to meeting with you.
See you soon.
Okay, so we're here with Brendan Augmentson, chief economist at BCREA, or the British Columbia Real Estate Association, past guest fan favorite, part of the 10-timer club. So many different ways to introduce Brendan Augmentson, but one of our favorites. So welcome back, Brendan.
Good to be here. Always good to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, Brendan, thanks for coming back on. Well, I guess we have to start. For anyone who's not familiar with you, tell us a little bit about yourself briefly, I guess, and then we can get into the juicy stuff.
I think the first time I was on this, I said that I was a street walking cheetah with a heart full of napalm, but I've moved away from that recently. I'm the chief economist of the BC Real Estate Association. We are a industry association. We represent realtors, 25,000 realtors across the province. My department in particular does economic research, and we report on stats and go out and talk to the media and the public and podcasts and all that kind of stuff.
So, Brendan, we're exactly almost halfway through the year as of today. So it's a timely interview. How has the year gone so far?
Very slow. Basically, every market we track around the province is down year over year. Actually, every province we track is down year to date, up to May. Good news is there were some bright spots last month. The island picked up a bit. Parts of the interior picked up. Chilliwack picked up. And then in June, we're seeing some decent data out of Vancouver, not so much out of the Fraser Valley, which was flat month over month and is still kind of tracking 35% below its 10-year average. Vancouver, which had been similar to Fraser Valley, and that was 35% or so below the 10-year average, this month is looking more like 20-25% below. So decent start to the month, has slowed a little bit at the end of the month, but we're going to come in ahead of last year, which is a small victory, but hopefully also maybe some signs of a bit of a momentum heading into the second half of the year.
Can we talk a little bit about how exceptional it is that we're down year over year almost every month in 2026?
Well, because down year over year from a terrible, it's down year over year from a 2025 that was the worst in about 25 years. Yeah.
That's right. I was going to say, because 2025 had people pulling out their hair and you were like, it can't get any worse. Like it can't. And it has. Has that surprised you? And I'm trying to think back to January when you were last on the show and you had your forecast.
Yeah, we started the year, like January was a very, very slow month. February was very slow. Basically, January, February were well below 2025. And since then, we've basically kept pace with 2025 from about March till May, a little bit under, like, down, 2-5% below last year for most of those months. June is looking like the first month we're actually going to be above 2025's rate and puts us on a track to be, finish the year like at about 23,000 sales, which isn't great. But we were like the start of the year tracking sub 20,000 sales annualized for GVR, which would be, one of the lowest years on record. So we started the year kind of historically slow. And fortunately, we're kind of starting to see things pick up and some optimism that the second half of the year is going to be a little bit better. Like no one is expecting a strong year this year or a strong, even a really strong second half, but something that's closer to like a 25,000 sale annual pace is going to even out, the weak first half and then hopefully a stronger second half.
Hey, Brendan, if we think about the different product types, so like condos, townhomes, half duplexes, single family detached, what's the weakest product type right now?
Yeah, it's apartments. Well, apartments are basically flat this month year over year. Townhouses and single family are both probably up about 5-10% year over year. Apartments, though, still lagging. Prices not moving that much, though. Like, prices are pretty flat. I think for the total year to date, we're down about 1% or something, maybe 2% in prices. Even apartment prices, like for all the talk of how weak the market is, especially how weak the condo sector is, average price in an apartment still like around the 750s for GVR. Like, it's not really moving that much.
So one thing we've been thinking about, is, it's a market where people are moving through the market. The investors are gone. That's kind of we've talked a lot about that. And there's like a logic to that I think most people can intuit, right, in this market. The one kind of surprise, or maybe not surprise, I wonder if you have any thoughts, totally anecdotally, first-time homebuyers seem to be missing. So it's like that entry-level product in the condo market space doesn't have the investors, but it also, it seems to me the slowest area.
Yeah,
and do you have any thoughts on the home on first-time home buyers, like where they are and what's the problem?
Yeah, like think about the three types of buyers: investors, move-up buyers, first-time home buyers. Because of policy, essentially, investors have been completely chased out of this market. And then for first-time home buyers, affordability obviously is really difficult. Even like an entry level, like an apartment in Vancouver, is more expensive than a single-family home in Calgary, right? So you're seeing a lot of like migration to Alberta for first-time home buyers for affordability reasons. And you look at the job market for the first 5 months of this year. The employment rate, so the share of people aged 20 to 24, was the lowest it's been in like 20 years, you know, outside of the pandemic. So the job market for young people is really tough. Affordability is really tough. You know, that combination of things, and you know, rents are coming down, so maybe renting's a little more attractive. Just really hard for first-time homebuyers to get into the market, right? Employment, if your job is tough, and you're, even if you're worried about your job, as maybe we'll get to some of the data on like, you know, how households are feeling about their job prospects for the next 12 months. Yeah, we have kind of a perfect recipes for really low first-time homebuyers and almost non-existent investors. So I think the market's being kind of carried by the move-up buyers, right? And you know, in some markets, that's actually pretty attractive right now. If you're in the Fraser Valley and you say you're in a townhouse or apartment, single family home is a lot more affordable now than it was 3 or 4 years ago. So we're seeing some movement there, but that's only, you know, one part of the overall housing ecosystem. And it's kind of shouldering the entire burden of market activity.
Anecdotally, Brendan, it feels like condos in Vancouver are busier than the rest of the region. Is that accurate, or is that just what it feels like?
Hard to say. I mean, a lot of parts of the province don't have a lot of condos in general, like, but like for bigger cities, like I think it's probably, I know Victoria's apartment market was very weak for quite some time, especially like the downtown core, for, you know, similar reasons to why Vancouver's downtown cores has had some real weakness. It's just like, there's some real like poverty and homelessness issues in those areas that are making it maybe not as desirable in some of those neighborhoods. But you know, generally it's a really tough situation, right? Because affordability is the biggest issue in Vancouver and in Victoria, other big cities. But like prices haven't moved that much on apartments. It's not like they're a great deal right now. It's not like we've had like you can get an apartment in most parts of Vancouver at a huge discount from where they were a few years ago. Like they haven't really moved that much. So you've got first-time homebuyers who would like to get into the market. It's not easier now necessarily than it was a few years ago.
I was actually thinking like, and sorry, I should have framed that better, but just in thinking about the lower mainland specifically, like, and one of the things, the ideas we've been kind of bouncing around on this show is that at least when you take like Metro Vancouver and you think about like Tri-Cities and like a lot of development in Burnaby around the SkyTrain stations, there seems to be a lot of inventory that's sitting and has been sitting quite some time. There's also seems to be a lot of downward pressure, where I don't think we've really quite experienced the same thing in, say, like Vancouver East or Vancouver West.
Sure.
And what we were kind of wondering is, does it make sense now that affordability has gotten a little bit better, that people are pushing to get maybe into the Vancouver market and not being pushed out by affordability into these SkyTrain spots? And Matt, you can elaborate on this a bit.
Well, no, I was just saying sort of the two things just to add on to that. One is, and this was your point, Adam, like if you're shopping in Coquitlam, you're going, okay, do I want to live in Coquitlam Center? I could live in Port Moody, maybe Poco. The inventory is so, there's so much of it, and you're kind of not wedded to a neighborhood, at least a lot of the anecdotally, that's what we're seeing. Whereas in Vancouver, it's like kind of a reversion to the mean. Like, okay, actually, Vancouver area code is more attractive.
Yeah, I think there's some of that in that Vancouver condo price has been pretty flat. I mean, for kind of like over like a 5-year kind of time frame, let's say.
Right.
Whereas like a lot of those outlying markets kind of started catching up to Vancouver. So now like the difference between paying whatever in East Van or wherever versus like New West or Coquitlam or Burnaby, it's like the this is not as much of a gap perhaps as there used to be. So it's still very expensive. Like I went to looking at some new apartment, first time homebuyer kind of event. And like, you know, the prices, it is Coquitlam, and like the prices are pretty high. And they're like, they're not dissimilar to what you'd see in Vancouver. Yeah. So yeah, I think there is some of that regional convergence in price. So now, yeah, perhaps buyers are like, well, it's an extra $20,000 or $25,000 to be in Vancouver versus New West or Coquitlam or somewhere else.
I guess another way to frame it is, are we getting, that all happened during COVID, right? Where, you know, we spent 3 years on this show going, I can't believe Surrey's as expensive as downtown Vancouver. And during this downturn, we're slowly getting back to, you know, people are starting to realize, wait a second, this never made sense. And we're getting where there's slightly more demand in Vancouver now than.
Yeah, well, it's interesting though, because in some of those, like Surrey and Langley, like prices have come down considerably in those.
Yeah.
Markets. So like,
right.
They were like, you know, Surrey condos look a lot more like Toronto condo prices. Like they've come down considerably, whereas Vancouver really hasn't. So I think there's still, that's why like I'm kind of puzzled at why the Fraser Valley market in general is as weak as it is, because affordability is the best it's been in 5 years. And they've got way more demographic pressure than most of Vancouver. And yet we're just not seeing any bounce back.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. What about, so single family homes? I know at least in the city of Vancouver, well, in Greater Vancouver Realtors stats, at least there was a, much ado about sales volume going up for a couple months. And now it seems to have petered out. Have you been tracking single family? I think obviously the Fraser Valley is a different animal altogether, but how's it performing? What's your take?
It's up year over year, but again, compared to a really terrible 2025. So like, but it's actually stronger than the apartment market, which is interesting, right? But I think it's more speaks to that idea of like move up buyers carrying this whole market, because you know, who else can afford to move into a $2 million single detached home, right? You'd have to have a fair amount of equity. So that's the part of the market where we're seeing more activity. You know, townhouses too are up year over year, but like, you know, I think the bulk of the market is people that can move up or move sideways into something, you know, maybe they've had their eye on a home and now it's 5% off of what it used to be and whatever. But that's where we're seeing the bulk of the activity. I think that's why we've seen the single family market, which had been languishing for a while, start to pick up a bit. It's never going to like come back, right? Like, especially in a market like Vancouver, it's always going to be a bit more of a niche product. It's so expensive. And there's just fewer and fewer single family homes because of rezoning. But yeah, it has seen more activity this year.
It's remarkable, because I've been doing this over the last few months, but it's remarkable to look at what seems like a decent amount of inventory of single family houses. And then you strip away like the teardowns and you strip away the assemblies, and like the turnkey homes almost across the board are so few and far between. It's such a limited inventory of actual livable properties, right? And the other thing I was just going to mention, because I'm noticing like anecdotally, we've had a few townhomes that have sold to single family or first time home buyers. And I'm wondering if affordability has kind of just reached a slight, like a reachable level for people to almost skip entry level condos in some markets. You know,
it depends on like, this is probably like getting a pretty sizable gift for first time home buyers, like a sizable gift perhaps from.
Sure.
We're doing some like really preliminary research right now. I'm building this model to study, just actually asking the question, like, say you're 20 today with today's prices and policies and potential price growth. What do homeownership rates look like projecting out like over the next 40 years? Like if you're a 20-year-old, you know, if you take a 20-year-old cohort, they're going to grow and some are going to have high income, some are going to have low income, some are going to have high savings, some low savings. How many can actually become homeowners without an inheritance or a gift? So you can, in the model, you can inject like age 30, this share of households gets $50,000, $100,000, whatever. What does that do to homeownership rates? So what happens without it? I think it's the fascinating part. Like what if that like, you know, bank of mom and dad or that giant amount of like looming inheritance equity isn't there? Like what does that actually do to homeownership given like a stress test and everything else? So we're doing some of that preliminary work, but like obviously if you're like 30, unless you're like really lucky or you're really smart or whatever, you've got an incredibly high paying job and you've managed to put together a lot of savings, pretty tough to get a single family home in basically any market in Metro Vancouver.
You know, one thing that strikes me just so far in this conversation, Brendan, is it feels like, you know, apart from the fact that sales are at historic lows, it's the same conversation we've had for the last decade, right? Like, yeah,
affordability stuff,
like, nothing has really gotten better.
It's interesting. Like, we've got our piece coming out next week, really talking about, like, I think this is actually a really interesting period in time, and like the sequence of events that's happened, I think it actually really explains a lot of why the market's where it's at. Like, specifically, like the importance of, like, you know, supply shocks in the economy, which means, like, you know, supply shock, when the economists talk about, we mean that the supply side of the economy, the production side. We've had all these supply shocks, like COVID shut down global supply chains and shut down a lot of like goods production. So like that meant prices start to go up and growth is falling at the same time. Like, we can't produce as much stuff as we would otherwise. So in a supply shock, you have growth that's falling, which is bad for the economy, but you also have prices that are rising because it creates shortages. We had the pandemic supply shock. We had like the uncertainty tariff supply shock, which is like an uncertainty shock, which hits the supply side of the economy because it means businesses don't want to invest or hire. They're not going to produce more if they don't know if they can sell into their largest market, for example. And then this year we have both an energy shock because of the Iran war and a labor force shock because of immigration policy. So we've had like three huge, like a year, basically 2021, 2026, nothing but supply shocks. And the thing about supply shocks is they're really bad for interest rate sensitive sectors. So like housing, because now you have growth that's falling. So we have an economy that's growing, like in BC, we've been growing like 1 to 1.5%, which means incomes aren't rising as fast as they would be otherwise. But also prices are rising, so inflation is rising, and the Bank of Canada can't lower rates. And in fact, because inflation is rising, bond yields are anticipating a tighter monetary policy, or we actually had tighter monetary policy come out of the pandemic. So you have rates that are higher, growth that's lower. It's the exact recipe for a really, really bad housing market. And that's what we've had for the last few years, is a market that's way, way below normal. And I think that explains it really well. Like, that's a really unusual kind of succession of supply shocks hitting the economy. Normally, you know, we're used to like a demand shock, right? Where like there's some sort of crisis or whatever. And like the financial crisis is a big demand shock, you know, just whatever. And we know how that works. You know, growth falls, but inflation falls as well, and the Bank of Canada can lower rates. We're used to those types of cycles. This is really, really strange and particularly bad for the housing market.
So if you listen to the explanation there about supply shocks, which makes a lot of sense, and you're kind of a Martian and you land in BC and don't know anything about housing over the last 10 years, you'd probably look at this plan from the province in Ottawa to buy 2,200 condos as like, the government's really worried about housing and really concerned about, you know, getting the market back on its feet. The strange thing about it is, I feel like since about 2017, the provincial government's done everything to keep us down, right? To keep the market throwing everything. So it's like a weird pivot. What was your take on this plan when you heard it? And then kind of secondarily, what, if anything, do you think the impact is on the market?
Yeah, we did a lot of work on this because like the idea is that there's so much inventory, unsold new inventory right now in the market. So if you're just looking at condos, I think there's 4,300 unsold new units in Metro Vancouver. There's about 600 or so in Victoria, and like 600 in Kelowna, and 200 in Abbotsford. If you just look at like the bigger kind of CMAs, so there's a fair amount of supply, the highest. And if you look at all of it, all over the province, including all types, it's like almost 8,000 units, the highest on record, at least going back to the early 90s. The last time we had this amount of inventory, developers stopped building. We had a supply crunch by 2014, 2015, and then prices massively accelerated. So to prevent that from happening again, and like when we've modeled it out, like start, you know, in our models, have our initial conditions, have this amount of inventory, what happens if it takes as long to clear that inventory as it did post-financial crisis. If that happens, we have a supply shortage by about 2028, 29, and then we start to see demand coming back and prices accelerating. So you're setting yourself up for like another, like a, you know, bad time for affordability, unless we can get developers to keep building. Our recommendation from all that modeling was we need to direct some demand inventory. And so our recommendation was eliminate the GST for all buyers, not just first-time home buyers, for new homes, and augment the foreign buyer ban to an Australia model, where now you can have foreign investors buy new units and pre-sales, but they can't buy resale housing. So just directing some demand through policy. The other things we recommended were cutting DCCs, somehow funding municipal infrastructure a different way. We got that part of it. Like, this should have been, the funny thing is, like, this should have been a really positive announcement, because they did a lot of really good work potentially on reducing DCCs and making the cost of delivery lower. But they also have this plan that had no details whatsoever to purchase 2,200 unsold units or empty units and convert them to rentals. So the first message, there was no detail. So when I read it, I was like, okay, this is going to be the same as the Ontario model. So Ontario is doing the exact same thing, but they're using about $300 million in provincial money as loans that the private sector can then leverage to purchase units in bulk and convert them to rental. But it's mostly a private sector initiative, just using some, you know, a nominal amount of money. $300 million is a lot of money, but not in terms of what, you know, the scope of this issue. But it's a private sector initiative, essentially. I thought it'd be the same thing. Government would put up a little bit of money for loans to private pools of money, and then they would go out and see if any developers are interested in this type of program. Then I saw the price tag, and it's like $1.5 billion, which is about $660,000 per unit, which means it sounds like the province is buying these units. So like, for the same number of units that are in Ontario, it's costing the provincial government $300 million with no federal money. In BC, it's $1.5 billion. And it just sounds like the government might be bulk buying these units and then perhaps converting them to rental. I don't know. I don't think it's a very good idea. It's really expensive. And the private sector doesn't get involved. Yeah.
Wasn't there's some sort of, I know everything's vague, but I was under the impression too, there might be a kind of rent to own.
Yeah,
sort of
there's that idea that, yeah, which fine, maybe that can work. It's a very expensive, though, price tag for not a lot of units. I mean, we're talking about 2,200 rental units going into an ecosystem of 700,000 rental units across the province. Like, you know, that's going to be concentrated, I guess, in larger cities where this is actually an issue, I assume. But that doesn't make that much of a difference, right? It does when we've modeled it. Like, I was looking at it, like, it's the problem is that it's a one time or like a kind of a bulk impact. So you get like inventory that falls, but then nothing else has changed. This doesn't spur like other demand in the market. So then it still takes a while for the rest of the inventory to clear. So it does help a little bit in generating some extra construction activity, which is the whole point. Like, we want to reduce that inventory so developers can keep building. That's the whole point of the policy. From our point of view, we need developers to keep building. So let's reduce their costs and let's try and clear this inventory so we don't run into the risk of a shortage later on this decade. And that turned into this kind of rent-to-own program that maybe the government's running. And it doesn't make a lot of sense. Developers didn't ask for it either. They don't have to participate. Like, it could be that this program doesn't buy a single unit if developers don't want to sell into it, right?
But if the fundamentals haven't changed and I'm a developer and yeah, I get a one-time bailout, like, that doesn't exactly make me want to get shovels back in the ground, right? I mean,
no, there's nothing, there's no new source of demand. It's not like the government's going to keep buying these units. It's a one-time effect. So, you know, it clears a bit of inventory, maybe injects some capital, but yeah, does it actually incentivize developers to build more?
Like, is it actually a bailout? Is that the right framing? Like,
it depends on what the cost ends up being compared to whatever, you know. It's not a bailout if all the developers are losing a lot of money, right?
And I think we're early days. Like, I saw Christine Boyle on, there's almost like a meme video going around about her on some global news or whatever. Yeah. And they ask her like 30 questions and she doesn't answer one of them. So it sounds like there's not a lot of clarity really yet.
It doesn't sound like they thought it through that in a lot of detail, right? Beyond like the announcement, because, you know, nature abhors a vacuum. So now, you know, everyone has kind of filled in the details on their own. Like you asked the average person on social media, the government is going in, making developers whole. And this is like a huge scandal bailout. And like, there's actually no details and developers don't have to sell at all. I mean, I don't know what the price is going to be. Who knows? I don't know how they're going to price this. Like, that's why you would rather like have the private investors go in running a program like this instead of like the government. And then beyond that, like, where does this money even come from? Like, we've got a government that's running a record deficit, and they just promised not just for this, but like a lot of money, you know, matching the government on kind of DCC relief, infrastructure funding, and a bunch of other stuff. Like, that's a lot of promises for a government that's running double digit $1 billion deficits.
It's interesting, like the trying to follow the logic, right? And that's kind of what I was trying to get at with, like, if you were an alien and you showed up, you'd be like, oh man, these guys must really be trying to help the development industry, which clearly I don't think that's the case.
It's like helping but not knowing how to help, right? And I don't know that this.
Would the help though in your mind be because after 10 years, it's like an about face, like, oh my God, we need to get this industry back on its feet? Or is it, this is an opportunity to get the government more involved in providing housing, or like what? I'm trying to kind of run through the.
I think everyone
the logic.
I think everyone is though. Like the one that made sense to me is creating sources of demand through either like GSE elimination, right? Well, now like it's more affordable. Maybe push some demand in that direction. And it seems very clean at the federal level. Just like, I don't know why you couldn't do this. They seem to be resistant to it for whatever reason. But you're creating demand. Even like the foreign buyer ban or augmenting the foreign buyer ban, like that's pushing demand that, you know, can be a constant source versus this like one-time purchase. I guess from their point of view, they feel like if they can buy it at a certain price, then that's cheaper than if they built 2,200 units of affordable housing. But like, I'm not sure they know why they're doing this. Like if it's purely for the reason that we need to clear inventory to get developers building again, there's just better ways to do it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, not the second kind of confusing part is, but we've seen this before, is like unveiling a fairly large policy move without providing any detail or having any thought. Like it strikes me as like, if I showed up to a listing presentation without having done any of the homework, I'd be in a better spot than these guys consistently coming out with these large policy pronouncements with like, it's like, did you think of this on the way to the microphone? Like, that's how it feels. It's like such a bizarre and ongoing. They do it consistently.
It was kind of an add-on in the initial announcement, and it overwhelmed everything else. Right. I don't know why they did it that way. I don't know if they have details about it, but don't want to share them. I really don't understand. I don't know why they didn't follow the Ontario model where, like, you know, when Ontario did this, I don't remember anyone screaming bailout. Right. Because there was like, it was just getting private investors. And even in Vancouver, I think some people like Mark Goodman, I think, was advocating for that type of model in DC. And they kind of took all of that, and then at some point, I don't know, too many cooks or whatever it was, they came out with this other program. And we still don't know what the details are, right? Like, I'm assuming it's the government buying these units and operating them. Who knows what it is? It's just the price tag is enormous compared to the exact same program in Ontario.
I just have one more question about this before we move on, and it's one that a client asked me. So let's assume 2,200 units in the shadow market are off the table. They're bought, they're cleared, we're good, they're used in the rental market or whatever. Does that have any impact on the resale market? Should people engaged in the real estate market think that this will have any sort of meaningful impact?
So the way our models work, inventory declines And that spurs some extra construction activity because there's no longer that unsold inventory hanging over their decision to build. And in a couple of years, you get more units. So it actually means lower long-term prices. Doesn't really necessarily, maybe that spurs some sales activity, but it's not a huge impact in the resale market. Because like, really, why should it be? It's not like, this isn't like organic kind of demand causing this inventory to decline. Even it's a one-time government purchase. I'm not sure why that would spur anyone to then go out and buy a home. Like, I'm not sure what the logic mm-hmm. connection is. It doesn't necessarily even affect, it's not like prices move unless they're going to be resetting lower on new stuff. So this kind of benchmark from the government. I don't know. I don't see huge impacts to the resale market though.
Maybe some people might even just pull back because they don't want to compete with the government.
Well, it's also confused. Like, are they buying whole buildings? Are they buying select units in certain buildings? I have no idea how this is supposed to work. Right? That's like, they can't be buying whole buildings. So then you're buying like penthouses and stuff. So I assume they're buying like lower floors of some buildings. I don't know. Like, it seems like a nightmare. Why would they even want to do this? Like, the administrative costs alone.
Well, this is
how
this
would
is
you how would you figure that out?
And so then what happens after they own these buildings? Like, do they create another branch that deals with tenancy issues and how do repairs in these units? Like, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. It's,
I don't know why they would want this headache. I don't get it. I don't know why they want to do it. I'm hoping they don't. I mean, it seems like there's been so much blowback. I mean, I think even EB came out and was like, we don't have to do this essentially. And again, it's not a mandate. Like, developers don't have to sell to them, and they don't have to do it. Like, they're just like, they can just like tap their chest, be like, this one's on us, guys. We're pulling back on this project. Again, like, it should have been easy messaging that it has turned into like an absolute, it's just all this blowback all of a sudden for something that should have been positive.
But and also he's getting it from all sides, right? Like, it's not is not a political winner for his base. It seems like the development community is kind of like, wait, what? Like
it. Yeah, even the developers don't like it because now they're being painted with this brush like, oh, you guys need a bailout now, the times are bad. Like, they don't like it either.
Yeah.
So what in your mind then, Brendan? I mean, we're halfway through the year. We're in 2026. A lot of people in, 2024, 2025 thought we'd be on a more balanced footing at this point in the market. What is it going to take to get to a better place in the market where people aren't feeling trapped, I think, in a lot of cases, right? Like, where we're seeing transactions increase across the board.
This is the other part of our report we're putting out next week. So, like everyone, I mean, we've been looking at like what are the causes of like this malaise? Because then you can maybe try and figure out how we get out of it. Last time I've been on the show, like, talking about policy uncertainty and like Andrew Liss, we kind of have a bit of a disagreement about whether or not that actually makes a difference. And so just kept thinking about like, well, what are the, like, how can we actually measure like, sentiment essentially? So if you follow me on LinkedIn, I mean, like, very tongue in cheek talking about vibes and just like the vibes are pretty bad. And so, but how do you quantify it? Right. Like, economists aren't good talking about feelings, and like, we were talking about the feelings of households. So I found a bunch of survey data. The Bank of Canada like produces this survey of consumer expectations, and they ask really interesting questions. And they ask questions like, what is the probability that you might lose your job over the next 12 months? And that's currently at the second highest level in the record for the survey. It all goes back to 2014, but like, it's like 20%. So the average household or the average person household saying like, there's a 20% chance I might lose my job in the next 12 months. And like when you read the details, some of that's related still to trade uncertainty, especially if you're in like the manufacturing sector or forestry or something. Some of it's AI. People are really worried about AI taking their jobs. But like, if you think there's a 20% chance you're gonna lose your job, you don't go buy a house, right? You don't buy a lot of stuff. But other things that survey too, like, households rate their financial conditions as poorer than they were last year. They're not expected to spend as much money. And then like, policy uncertainty is still really high. So we looked at all those things, all those survey results, and made it into a vibes index, which kind of extract the common kind of trend and all those things. And it correlates pretty well with home sales. And so like the vibes are really bad, but like, how do you change that? And like, you guys see this all the time. The other, my most popular chart maybe I've ever made is my, why is everyone so mad all the time in one chart, which is just like wages since 2021 versus housing costs and food costs. Wages have gone up 20%, shelter and food's gone up 30%. So when you guys are talking to clients, like that's the backdrop of their lives the last 5 years, is maybe their paycheck's growing, but their just everyday costs are growing even faster. And that creates a lot of like economic anxiety. So when we plot our vibes index versus, you know, have you heard of the misery index? Arthur Okun, this economist, like the 60s and 70s, created the misery index. And it's the most elegant kind of formulation for misery. Inflation rate plus the unemployment rate equals misery. So if you're out of a job and prices are rising, you're probably pretty miserable. And most of the time, our vibes index correlates super well with that misery index. So like, no surprise, the economy sucks. Everyone feels bad. The last couple of years, though, it's been a little bit divorced from that relationship because inflation's come down and the unemployment rate's not terrible, but people still feel really bad. And I think that that cost of living thing is a real part of that. Like, that's a hangover. The price level went up and never came back down. Never does. So the cost of living, housing affordability is still tough. All of that is just weighing on people now. They're worried about losing their job still. But there's no, like, you know, good vibes only legislation of 2026 that can pass through parliament. Like, it's really hard to change sentiment. Hopefully it can change as the economy gets better. And I think it will. There's a lot of stuff we're doing right now that are just slowing growth. Like, our immigration policy means that our population is shrinking. It's almost impossible for an economy to grow while its population is shrinking. So that's going to reverse in 2027, 28. We have a lot of new private sector, big private sector projects that are going to attract a lot of investment that are being fast-tracked through the Build Canada projects. I think we've got four or five big projects, LNG, mining projects, pipeline projects that could really jumpstart private investment that's been actually shrinking for the past 3 years. From 2028 to the end of the decade and beyond, we're going to have a lot more private investment. So there's lots of reasons to think the economy is going to start picking up next year and the year after. And that'll probably help with a lot of this, but like, people feel bad. I'm sure you guys see it in your clients all the time. Like, they don't feel like super encouraged about the state of the economy.
No, and that feeling of feeling like there's no agency is what I'm feeling in conversations with people. Because if you're worried about your job and you're trying to make a change in your life, like selling a property or downsizing, and you can't, now not only are you've lost your agency and you're stuck, right? I mean, we're having a lot of terrible conversations like every other broker in the city, I'm sure. And you feel the economy right now for sure.
I think we're closer to the end of this period than the beginning, you know, thankfully, but it's not going to resolve quickly. Like, there isn't like some magic pill for this. And even like, We should have had a first half of this year with lower interest rates. And that got kind of taken away by the Iran conflict, which spiked rates instead. And now we're kind of stuck where we are.
What about I'm just thinking, because like, you think about, you know, the checks in the mail or the checks come and due or whatever kind of language was used during COVID when, you know, there was this huge government's turned on, you know, kept the printing press on. And it felt like, thinking back then, it was like everyone felt rich, right? Like, and everybody spent money like drunken sailors. But I remember at the time, skeptics being like, okay, the check's coming due. It seems like we're in that moment. Whereas I'm just thinking about the roaring 20s, right? Like, wasn't the idea supposed to be that we were going to have this decade of like, no, it's a let it rip. And it feels like we're in the exact opposite.
We got through that period, though. Like, it's kind of immaculate that we had a soft landing after, you know, inflation spiking to 8%. We had rates above 5%. And the economy never tipped into recession, as most people thought it would. And we were coming through 2024, you know, thinking like, oh, maybe things are about to come back. Like, if you recall, like, home sales in end of 2024, the fourth quarter of 2024, were getting close to like the 10-year average. Things were really picking up. And then we had just nonstop you know, volatility and uncertainty and unpredictability, yeah, all caused from the same place. First with tariffs and uncertainty, and then again this other shock from the Iran conflict, which spiked gas prices. One more kind of nightmare for households every time they go to the gas station. And also, again, rates should have been coming down the first half of this year. The five-year bond yield before the Iran conflict was 2.6. And then all of a sudden, it was 3.3 because oil prices went over $100 and everyone was expecting, you know, this was never going to end. So, yeah, like this is, we're kind of living with this succession of unprecedented but totally avoidable shocks to our economy.
I wonder, you know, the other way to think about, or I'm just thinking out loud now, but kind of this idea of deglobalization and this kind of larger structural shift that we seem to be in globally. Like, I wonder if
it's more
some
like,
of this, like, I'm just thinking back to like Adam's comment that like people lack agency, and I'm not even sure you meant it in that, but it does seem like we're in a restructuring period combined with the AI revolution, whatever that looks like. You're like, It's a very uncomfortable moment.
Yeah, everyone in the world thought they had a reliable partner, and it turns out that partner wasn't so reliable. In fact, became quite hostile, and now we're looking for other partners. So that takes a lot, and you know, pretty tough to replace having a next door neighbor with a $30 trillion economy that you have an integrated economy with. Give me lots of ups and downs trying to find other sources of demand for your goods when you're so integrated with this global hegemon, right?
I can't help but feel like you're fairly optimistic about at the federal level, outside of all the doom and gloom. It sounds like you're feeling like Carney's made he's put some good seeds down.
I think it's good and bad. I mean, I was surprised the first budget they kept the immigration policy in place. I think that's a disaster. There's no reason for it to be at the speed that it is, and it's having huge ramifications for like the rental market and for universities and everything else. That didn't make a lot of sense. I'm assuming they're going to do away with the foreign buyer ban January 1st or augment it in some way. If they don't, that would be, I think, a huge misfire. He seems to understand, like, we need to source a lot of capital. So, like, when you hear the types of conversations a lot of the policymakers are having about, like, tax rates and that kind of, like, withholding tax rates and stuff that would apply to foreign investors, it seems like they recognize they need to find capital to finance a lot of these projects or even housing, new housing construction to hit their target. So he obviously understands those issues. And even the stuff on housing and like productivity, like the focus of their budget on long-term productivity makes sense. Like that's not something you can fix overnight, even with good tax policies. It can take a really long time, but at least they seem to understand the problem on the supply side of the economy. It's just really hard to fix. And even, and then they've like lost track completely though on things like interprovincial trade. Remember that? Remember when we were going to fix interprovincial trade?
Yeah.
What happened? Like, we just turns out most of our exports to the U.S. were still covered by CUSMA, so the tariffs weren't actually having as much of an impact as we feared. So now we don't have to actually worry about fixing this deeply structural problem with our economy. So there's lots more they could do on competitiveness and open trade within Canada. But, you know, so far, like, some of the policies, I thought most of their housing policies, especially on the supply side of things, were actually pretty good. And even this most recent announcement where they're recognized that DCCs are way out of control, but like there's no other way to finance municipal infrastructure. So why not use the borrowing, you know, low cost borrowing ability of the federal government to pay for it? Like, okay, that's fine. That's a quick solution for, you know, a government that's not super deeply in deficits in the way that our province or provincial government is.
I just wanted to go back to the Vibes Index specifically in relation to interest rates and where we're at, because, you know, for years, I feel like this is saying something we've said 100 times on this show, but, you know, everybody who was like a Bank of Canada economist there for a couple of years talking about interest rates, it doesn't seem to be that impactful on the market right now. I'm not sure anybody's expecting. It doesn't feel like we're really, if anything, we're thinking the yields are going up, as I understand. How where are we at with interest rates? Maybe let's put it that way. I'm not even sure. Like, it's like, is it vibes? Yeah, can interest rates save us? Maybe that's the question. Can interest rates save us? And what do interest rates do in the next 6 months to a year?
Yeah, I understand the confusion. I'm dead confused talking about it too, because it's sort of a, we had a window. Like the Bank of Canada last year, you had lowered rates 2.25%. And you know, 5-year bond yield was falling and mortgage rates tend to follow that 5-year bond yield. But then we had an Iran conflict that spiked inflation by our model suggested by a point. Turns out to be about a point. Bank of Canada had the same impact. And you had markets then expecting, because of rising oil prices and how that passes through to the rest of the economy and consumer prices and expectations, that then maybe the Bank of Canada and other central banks might have to start raising interest rates. That's combined with, like, separate from that, you have a U.S. economy that seems to be reflating. They haven't had nearly the growth struggles we've had, and they never got inflation really to target, and now they're above 4% again. That affects bond yields here. You have those combination of things where the sudden turn in what markets thought the central banks, especially the Bank of Canada, was going to do, this reflationary environment in the U.S. that's putting upward pressure on rates there and here and globally, and all of a sudden, you know, what the Bank of Canada does doesn't really matter that much, right? Bank of Canada's at 2.25%, but we had a 5-year bond yield that was like peaked around 3.3. And that probably means a 5-year fixed rate at about 4.7, 4.8, whatever it is, instead of 4.2, but which is where we should have been earlier this year. Now, even that the conflict is over, no one is it? No one knows. Oil prices seem to think so. They're back down. Nothing has actually changed, seemingly. Even though markets are no longer expecting the Bank of Canada to raise rates to counteract that inflation, now we kind of shifted a regime. Like, markets are just like mechanisms that digest expectations, right? They always change. We've seemed to have moved on in markets from Iran conflict caused inflation to, all right, over the next 2 years, what does the economy look like? And if in Canada, it's inflation at 2% and an economy that's growing close to trend, we don't need to be at 2.25%. We'll go back up to 2.75, the midpoint of what the Bank of Canada thinks is neutral for the economy. So 2.75 is where the Bank of Canada wants to be. That's sort of their Goldilocks place for the economy, for their overnight rate. If you look at expectations, whether you look at the 2-year bond yield, which is a good guide to what markets think the Bank of Canada is going to be out of the next 2 years, it's at 2.75, essentially. If you look at the forward curve for the Bank of Canada's overnight rate, it's at like 2.8, 2.9. So, like, markets basically expect that the economy is over this temporary shock, but now there's still a hiking bias because the bank's 50 basis points below where they want to be. And that gets priced in right away. So now the 5-year bond yield's hovering around 3 instead of 3.3. That's a 5-year fixed rate around 4.5. And that's probably where we're going to be.
Well, maybe perhaps we'll leave it there.
Rats is right. Well, like, we probably had a 6-month window where we would have had probably about a 4.25, 5-year fixed rate, uninsured rate, and didn't get it.
Yeah. Right.
Brendan, we got this segment called the 5-Wire, 5 lighthearted questions we end every show with. Can't go out on that note. We can't go out on... Nobody ends a podcast with rats. Okay, question number one. One book that you've read recently that you would recommend?
And you can I just say the summer reading list, Brendan, that you post on LinkedIn is always it's an exciting one. So I just want to say that.
Try and mix in a lot of fiction, nonfiction. I've read 3 books in June because the weather was really great. I could get in my float pool and just zone out. First one was Patrick Radden Keefe. I think actually Ryan really recommended Say Nothing. This is his new book. It's called London Falling. It's a fascinating story about...
Spoilers. I got 30 pages left.
Okay. It's incredible. It's fascinating. That story is wild. Then I read David Zale, is that his name? Flesh. It won the Booker Prize last year for fiction. I think won the Booker. A lot of adult themes. This one's not for kids, but also really, really interesting. And then I read Stephen Hyden's book about, it's like a cultural criticism about Bruce Springsteen, especially around the album Born in the USA. It's fascinating if you're a Springsteen fan like I am, but also just like a really interesting, I think you can kind of like, you know, whereas there are conservatives and liberals, I think there's also, and not in the same groups, be fascinating to see how these sorted people who like music versus lyrics. I'm very curious if more conservatives like a good melody versus a good lyrics, because if you listen to Born in the USA, that is not a positive song about America, but it was adopted by a lot of conservatives who apparently don't know how to parse lyrics. At the time, it being this very patriotic song.
Right. The Reagan era.
Yeah. It's not. I mean, it's about a Vietnam vet who comes home and can't find a job. And right, it's anyway, he's been abandoned by his country, essentially. That's what the song's about. Anyway, fascinating book.
Wow.
Just
okay.
Like, yeah, it reminds me, Like a Rock is not about a truck either. Yeah. That's just...
you know what this makes me think of? A movie that is not talked about as much as maybe it should be, and I haven't seen it for a while. Born on the 4th of July.
Oh, yeah.
You know who was very good friends with the author of Born on the 4th of July? What's his name? Ron something? Bruce Springsteen.
Really?
Read that, okay. Read there that you go. The book. They were good friends. Used to bring
that, yeah, yeah. Full circle. This one feels always wrong because I feel like we should just go literature and pop culture with you and music. But in the last few years, Brendan, what new belief, behavior, or habit has most improved your life? I feel like we often go powerlifting on this one, but I'll let you have it.
So I did. I should say I called my shot on the podcast at the start of the year, and I hit my PR. I hit it too easily, and now I'm like, should I keep going? But my shoulder has had other ideas, so I've slowed down.
What was the PR again? Can you remind everyone?
It was 335 pounds. So it was, but it moved fast. So I was like, maybe I have 350 in me. But I don't know.
Do you have any idea of the age when you should be at your peak when it comes to?
Not 46. I don't think.
I was going to say, that's a crazy time to hit the PR.
Yeah. But I'm pretty banged up, and I'm 46. I'm losing my window for more PR. So maybe I'll stop powerlifting. Maybe that's the new belief, or what is it? maybe that's what it is. Maybe I can finally stop chasing.
Do you just out of curiosity? Does somebody spot you, or do you use like a Smith type machine or something with the? Or,
you should be on LinkedIn.
Oh, you have this. You already covered this. You have the
how
bars.
Dare you,
the...
How dare you suggest Smith? No, it has some spotters, so I can easily dump the weight if I needed to. Which I've done at that weight last year. It was all right. Wasn't as harrowing as it sounds.
Matt, you're just dumbbells though, right? That's the so. What do you just drop them? I guess.
Yeah, I just draw them on the side.
The 35s.
Dumbbells don't go up. Like,
oh. So I got a 35 caught on my neck. anyway, what have you been watching? Favorite movie, a recent movie, or show? So binge watching.
I went on a run at the theater, so I saw Obsession, which is great. The horror movie everyone's talking about.
Oh, right.
Very, very good. And then I also saw Backrooms the same week, which is also a horror movie, which is excellent. Really enjoyed that. Saw the new Spielberg. It's a mess, kind of. It's kind of fun, but it's a total mess of a movie with Disclosure Day. And then TV, Widow's Bay. It's really fun. And The Agency season 2 just came out. And being a 46-year-old father, I just binged through The Agency in like 3 days because it's my favorite genre of anything, which is smart people talking in rooms.
I can't remember who on this show recommended Reacher. Have you heard of Reacher? It's just legitimately, it's just the scenario where some guy does something like, hey, like get away from my car. And then he gets his, and then Reacher kicks the hell out of like 50 guys, whatever that scenario, like, you know,
whatever
like,
that genre is,
whatever that genre is, it's just that over and over and over again. It's like the movies for guys who like movies, but it's a or show or whatever, but it's crazy.
Best sort of Reacher I've ever heard. I've watched every season. It's about a large man who solves problems with his largeness. And then the twist for the last season was like, there's a guy who's bigger than Reacher, and like that was like a plot point. Like, it was even bigger than Reacher. How's this gonna go? So yeah, it's
still the Reacher.
The show is aggressively stupid, but it's pretty fun. But like those shows, when they, I feel like the first season, like he beat some guys up, but like they didn't have like a body count. But then like I feel like he killed like 48 people in the last season of Reacher. And like, are there consequences for anything?
It's pretty great. Yeah. Okay, question number four. Favorite band or music? What have you been listening to?
A lot of stuff, but there's a great band. I'm just a guy, and I can't remember his name. The band Current Joys. It's like an indie rock band. We got the same guy also has a band called Surf Curse, I think. Just really, really good indie rock. His 2024 album is really good. I can't remember what it's called. I was listening to that a lot. I was going back and I was on the train today and listened to like the second Rock on Tours album. Remember the Rock on Tours, Jack White?
Yeah. And Brendan Benson?
That's a good record. I forgot how good it was. And I was a big Brendan Benson fan and a big White Stripes fan. So like those two together, that's a really good record. I think it's the second one that's quite good. So yeah, that's what I've been listening to like most recently.
Nice.
Last but not least, something you've purchased for under $1,500 that's had a positive impact on your life since January.
I don't buy a lot of stuff besides books. So I was thinking about this. The last thing I bought for any real purpose was an immersion blender, like a hand mixer, which sounds stupid, but my 18-year-old son out of the blue texted me and he said, "Hey, would you be interested in making the soup that we had in Normandy like 2 years ago? We had this like fish soup in Normandy. It's the best soup I've ever had. I've thought about it at least once a week since we were there." And I was like, "Sure." And like, if you guys will get there, like when your 18-year-old is like, "Would you like to do something with me?" You're like,
"I just put my jaw. What are we doing?" He's like, "Just kidding."
You know, like, yeah. But then, you know, you need, because this, you have to, you just basically, it's a fish soup with like a bunch of cod and there's prawns and stuff in it, but you have to like blend it all into like a smooth, anyway. So I bought a hand mixer, worked great. Soup tasted great. It was a fun experience. And yeah, it was dope. So that was my one thing I've really purchased for a purpose. And it was great.
Oh, that's awesome.
Was it as good as the soup in Normandy?
It wasn't. It turns out if you've got like 40 years experience of making this soup, it's going to be a little bit better. But it was pretty good.
Hundreds of years of cultural tradition behind you.
Right? Yeah.
Especially the next day, especially, it was really good. You put like Gruyere in it and, you know, I made toast out some croutons and a bit of cream, I think. It's really good.
Fantastic. Man. Well, maybe we'll leave it there, Brendan. But how can people follow along? I feel like we've mentioned it a few times, but LinkedIn, I think, is the number one place. But how else can people find out what you guys are doing over at BCREA?
LinkedIn's a good place for my random thoughts. Otherwise, if you go to BCREA website, you can find everything that we produce on our website. And yeah, otherwise you can see me on the speaking circuit. So might, if you're a realtor listing, and you know, I might come to your office and do a presentation. I've done that a lot. So yeah, always happy to go out and talk to realtors.
Excellent. Well, hey, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks, Ben.
So there you have it, folks, our discussion with BCREA Chief Economist, Brendan Augmundson.
Always so many takeaways, and I'm always scribbling down his five-wire responses because I feel like we all kind of sync up on our what we do with our downtime, except the reading part.
Except the reading. Except and going to the movies, yeah. I don't do as much. Also, I don't lift weights. He's in a good place. Men of a certain age.
we both like music. Anyways,
that's right. You know, but it did strike me, Adam, when this was back in the George W. Bush days. They said you need to be able to want to go for a beer with a guy to vote for him. And if that was the case, I think I'm all for Brendan Augmundson for prime minister here. That was I feel like. He's a guy. It's too bad he lives out in Maple Ridge or wherever he lives far away. But be good to grab a beer with that guy. He's an interesting guy to talk to.
For sure, Matt. What else do we got before we cut for the day?
We have nothing except to say we have worked with hundreds of people who listen to this show over the years, and we've had wild success and some of the best people we've met in the industry come from the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast community. If you're looking to buy or sell, we'd love to hear from you. We'd love you to share our contact because, Adam, we're in growth mode. The market is slow, but we're in growth mode. And we have resources for buyers and sellers at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. If you want to talk about that or anything else, give me a shout at any point, 778-847-2854 or Matt@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or Adam@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
And of course, we got that Kokomo line, info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Well, have a great week, everybody. Please share this episode if you think it would be valuable for anybody in your sphere. Otherwise, we'll see you next week.
Take care.
2,000 Spaces for Radio. Subscribe today.